So these lectures will probably be strange to most of you, but there's no excuse not to understand them, because I'm not an experimentalist, although I will be mostly talking about experiments, and tomorrow one experiment. In fact, this is already out of date. I'm going to try today to give you an overview of what particle astrophysics is. And the lectures, if I had known, it's actually, I was at this school last year, and it was at Snow, and most of the students were experimentalists, and most of them were neutrino physicists. So now I come to a totally different audience, but then I decided, since it doesn't matter really, because what I'm going to tell you about is probably so strange that it doesn't matter what you do. And in fact, that's what's exciting about particle astrophysics. Most of these things don't have a tradition. They're just dreamed up and tried. And tomorrow I'm going to tell you about the experiment I work on, IceCube, which is a neutrino experiment, strange neutrino experiment. And yeah, we made some discovery, and I will tell you about it. But you're going to get me in trouble if it goes outside this room. But the reason I have to go to Washington, because NSF is giving a press conference on Thursday about the results. So I'm sorry it's front-loaded, and it may be a bit difficult to take.
I should warn the audience that Francis started as a theorist, so don't let him put you off.
I'm still a theorist. I actually, early in the IceCube experiment, actually soldered some electronics boards. And I was actually good at it. I'm proud. But I don't think I've ever held a screwdriver. So today, particle astrophysics, tomorrow, IceCube. This will be, you know, probably helpful. If you are ever interested in anything I say, you can probably find it in this preprint, which is about 100 pages. And so you can go and read there if you are interested in something and you didn't understand it during the lecture. Because, you know, it's the type of lecture by the time that you know what's going on, I'm already on something else. And but so you can always go back there. I will send this to you as a PDF. I won't sell it. as soon as someone gives me the right address to send it to. I also have to tell you that, I mean, I cannot introduce particle astrophysics to you. This is a slide that covers the experiment that I will talk about tomorrow, IceCube. It lists everything we have written a paper on. So this is not propaganda. We have written a paper on a published refereed paper, at least one, on each of these subjects. And it tells you 6 hours is not enough. I need like 60 hours.
Including glaciology?
Pardon?
Including glaciology?
Of course, you will find out. In fact, there was a short period in my life that most of the papers I wrote were in glaciology. I'm glad that is over. But yeah, I will tell you a little bit about glaciology, I hope, at some time. So I actually, unfortunately, maybe not, have chosen astrophysics to concentrate on during these lectures. But for instance, I mean, this is the beauty of particle astrophysics. You never know. It's really a purely experimental subject. You build something, and you know, you will see what you do with it. If you build something, in fact, you know, we sold Ice Cube. I'm coming back to Ice Cube because that's the thing I work on. Ice Cube is, well, you will not only know what it is by tomorrow evening, you will be sick of it. But it's an experiment that detect neutrinos. And we promised that we would discover neutrinos from the cosmos, just like you see X-rays and gamma rays from the cosmos. And we promised that we would find the sources of the cosmic rays. And I actually thought, if we can make something like this work, we'll do some interesting physics. Some of it we hadn't thought about yet. That's on this slide. But actually, the strange thing with Ice Cube is that we actually delivered what we promised. It's very unusual. Usually, you do something else, and it's always more interesting than what you set out. You know, this is how astronomy works. In these talks, when I was asking for money, I always used to have a slide that showed why people dreamed up a telescope and then what they actually did with it. And what they do with it is always much more interesting than what they build it. And so we may actually be the first telescope that delivered what it promised. But then we already see to see things that we don't understand. And most likely, that's more interesting than what I'm going to talk about. But I'll point this out tomorrow. I can give you examples. For instance, Galileo actually didn't invent a telescope. The telescope was invented. They were called spy glasses, by people in Flanders and England. And during the Middle Ages, when there was trade between the two, if you had a good telescope, you could see what's on the ship and sell it first. There is no evidence that anyone ever pointed it at the sky. And so Galileo was taught about this thing with a tube with two lenses. But he knew optics. It's amazing. Not only didn't they point at the sky, it was not developed scientifically. And he instantly improved it, I think, by a factor 30, if I remember well, in magnification. The X-ray telescope, which was developed by Rossi, was designed and built having in mind seeing X-rays from the moon. It's actually incredibly difficult to see X-rays from the moon. And he was certainly not going, in fact, there are only X-rays from the moon because particles hit the moon and there are reflections. But when they actually did the first X-ray observations, they found this huge source in the sky called SCOEX-1. It's one of the famous X-ray sources. And Physical Review Letters turned down the paper. They said, that's not just possible. And Rossi wrote a letter to Physical Review Letters saying, I guarantee that this experiment is correct and that the results should be published. And that was it. They published it. You can imagine I writing a letter like that. So, and I could go on and on every wavelength of light. So you build these things, and particle astrophysics is about building, you know, things and then see what happens. So most of my talks are going to be about neutrinos. So I want to specifically introduce neutrino astronomy. So it will be particle astrophysics, but with total emphasis on the neutrino part. I presume you all know what this is. This is the microwave background. And so astronomy is about, I'm a particle physicist, so a wavelength of 1 millimeter doesn't mean anything to me. but photons of 10 to the minus 4 electron volts do. So this is what the sky looks like if you have an instrument that detects light of 1 millimeter wavelength. And then, of course, you know, astronomers have been extremely good at making different wavelengths of astronomy work, inventing telescopes that give you different wavelengths. This is 1 electron volt. This is the sky you see when you look with your eyes. And you will see this is the plane of our, you mostly see our galaxy, probably not in Waterloo. And so our, I'll come back to what our galaxy is, but typically here you see it. Then we go to smaller wavelength, 10 to the minus 15 meters. That's something now we can relate to, 10 to the 9 electron volts. And so that's the sky in gamma rays. And you see again the galactic plane. It has become very thin now. It's only about 2 degrees wide. And you see some sources that are not in our galaxy. These are extragalactic sources. Take their sources outside our own galaxy. And then you continue playing this game and you go to, let's say, 10 to the 15 electron volts, and that's the sky. You don't see anything. And there is a simple reason for this. So actually, the magic number is 100 TeV. I'm going to try to use TeV units in this talk. Because 100 TeV is a magic number. That's where photons are unobservable. There's no light anymore coming from the sky. And at 100 TeV is where neutrino astronomy becomes easy. I will explain these things later, but I'm going to immediately explain to you why the sky turns dark at 100 TeV. Take some object very far away, billion light years, and it emits 100 TeV gamma ray. That gamma ray never gets to the Earth. The reason is you have to think of the universe. The universe is not an empty place. It's filled with lots of things, including one I already showed, 410 photons per cubic centimeter in this room and everywhere else. So this photon travels through a universe that's filled with 3-degree photons. And so at some point, it's going to interact with one of them and become an E plus E minus pair. Once it's an E plus E minus pair, it's a charged particle, 2 charged particles. With charged particles, you cannot do astronomy because our galaxy is filled with magnetic fields, microgauss, magnetic fields. There are magnetic fields outside our galaxy. We actually know amazingly little about them. But so these particles are just bent, like that cosmic ray there, that proton. You see, by the time it reaches the Earth, it doesn't tell you where it comes from. That's why the cosmic ray problem is still an open question. And so we don't see the universe anymore.
Francis?
Yes.
If you showed that thing that said you see nothing, would the galaxy have been there if you really took a picture, or is it?
The galaxy would still have been there, but it isn't there, as I will tell you later. No. I'm coming to that. Of course, photons are attenuated from the galaxy, but they still reach you, so there's no problem. Yes, of course, the offer stands more even than in the previous talk. Given the subject, interrupt me. When you're lost, just tell me. Yeah.
Why does that relate to a cutoff of 100 TeV rather than 50 TeV or 200 TeV?
No, that's just particle physics. or whatever, physics. So you can calculate the mean free part of a photon in the microwave background. In fact, I will do this later. I realize I'll do it for a cosmic ray. But you just, you know, you calculate the mean free part. The mean free part, I may as well introduce this now, is 1 over the density of the medium times the cross section. So this is, on average, how far, a photon will travel in a... So you take that 410 per cubic centimeter, and the cross-section is the cross-section for two photons to interact. And that cross-section looks something like this. And so when you hit this bump, your photon dies. And so you can calculate how far it comes from looking up. By the way, cross-sections, I will assume, is something you look up in the particle data book. I'm not going to calculate it. Life is too short for that. So you take that cross-section, and it will tell you how many centimeters the photon will go. And it will not reach us anymore. That's why Cliff asked, you know, eventually, when you come close enough, the grammage the photon sees becomes smaller and smaller. So from the galaxy, you can see the galaxy actually in 100 TeV photons. It's not easy, but it actually has been done. I will tell you about an experiment I did it recently. There is a 100 TeV map of the galaxy now, which is not public, but it exists. I have seen it. Another question, yes?
What kind of Feynman diagram is that interaction?
The normal leading order diagrams. Halsen and Martin. In case someone asks, I'm the same Halsen. Many years younger. Older. So, you just calculate QED diagrams. Gamma-gamma electron exchange.
So
yes.
If you have the charged particles or the uniform magnetic field, I can see where you wouldn't be able to tell where they were from. Wouldn't you be able to tell something about the magnetic field structure of the surrounding area?
Yes and no. Of course, you realize that's not the end of this story. Because these electrons will radiate, the photons will pair produce again. So what happens is that there's a cascade of particles developing. And that cascade actually can eventually reach the Earth. And that's a very interesting problem, which I will discuss tomorrow. Yeah. And it tells you something about the magnetic fields, but not very much. Okay. There is a solution, of course, to all this, that is to use neutrinos. Neutrinos, they don't interact with microwave photons. They actually don't interact with anything. So neutrinos, we don't know of any physics that would stop neutrinos from coming not just from the edge of the universe, but from the beginning of time, from the Big Bang. So, of course, the problem is that they also don't interact with your detector, and that's what tomorrow's talk is about. So, to summarize this, this is the universe as a function of the energy of the photon, and this is the part that's black. So, about 20%, 25% of the universe we have never seen. This is like the dark side of the moon. And you see, it can only be revealed by neutrinos. Now you say, maybe there's nothing there. No, we know there's something there. We know there are cosmic rays of this energy. We just don't know where they come from. And because they are charged, they are protons. And in fact, it's very intriguing. The very highest energy part of this, we actually now think they are heavy nuclei. It's a total mystery. So that's the idea. Now, who had this idea? Well, Reines, who invented the neutrino, told me that as soon as he and Cowan discovered the neutrino, everybody, including himself, instantly had the idea that you could do astronomy with it. Because, you know, it's neutral, it has no mass. In this talk, it has no mass. At TeV energy, the mass of the neutrino is completely irrelevant. So is it worth trying, of course, because neutrinos don't interact, it's not going to be easy to explore this region. Is it worth doing? And this is my slide as a particle physicist of why it's worth doing. Did you have a question? Yeah. Yeah.
Why does the opacity go down at the higher energies?
The opacity.
Like, the region that you can't see sort of like curves up.
It's Cliff's question. When you come to, there are two ways to look at it. When you come to lower distances, then you have not much target to go through, and you get through, actually. So we can see our galaxy here. This just traces the shape of the gamma-gamma cross-section.
Yeah, I'm not looking at the high energy
part. There's a little crush.
Okay. Oh, that's this peak. Eventually, you get over this peak and get through again. So this is just tracing the peak. Thank you for asking that question. In fact, I never said this before. This traces the peak of the gamma-gamma cross-section. It's 1 over sigma.
What's the second one that kind of... Right. There's upside down V when it starts going down again.
Ah, this is... No, it begins to interact with other photons. I'll come to that. So, beside microwave photons, the universe is not only not empty, it's a mess. Because the microwave photons are easy to talk about. But there's infrared light that fills the whole universe. I will show you this later. By the way, I don't mind saying I'll show you this later, because then you can make the connection. So please keep asking questions. I get very bored if there are no questions. So this has to do with infrared light. So here is the usual propaganda slide, which is not mine, it's to Michael Unger. And so is this problem actually worth? Of course, if you say, I'm going to look at this dark universe, it doesn't work. But if you say, I'm going to solve the cosmic ray problem, which is, by the way, cosmic rays were invented in 2012. That's 106 years ago. We have no clue where they come from.
1912.
What?
1920.
I said 20? 1912. 1912. I'll come back. 106 years ago. So if you actually looked at the highest energy cosmic rays, the highest energy cosmic rays have an energy of 10 to the 8 TeV. That's 10 to the 20th electron volts. A lot of this physics is done in electron volts, I'm afraid. So if you took LHC magnets and you wanted to accelerate that particle to its energy, you would have to fill the orbit of the planet Mercury with LHC magnets. And that's not how it's done. In fact, we don't really know how it's done, but we guess that's not how it's done. And, you know, this... So this is a... you know, how can you not try to solve this problem, right? So neutrinos are the answer. And we have already discussed this, but there's something else. Neutrinos track nuclear processes. If your interest is to find the source of cosmic rays, well, you find them by neutrinos, because you cannot get neutrinos from a source where there are only electrons and photons. And all of astronomy is done with electrons and photons. So I was always told there are no neutrinos. But there are cosmic rays. And where you accelerate protons, you produce pions, as I will tell you, inevitably. And they decay into neutrinos. So neutrinos will give you a picture of the sky that shows the cosmic ray accelerators. So you just build a neutrino detector and it's done. The problem is, this doesn't tell you how big a neutrino detector you need. And so, that's, I'll come back to that later. So here is your question. So what's in the universe? What's in the universe is the microwave background. So this is the flux as a function of wavelength here, energy of the photon there. So if you build, say, at this wavelength or this energy, something that's that big, this plot tells you how many particles you will catch per day in your detector. If it's bigger, more. If you look for longer, more particles are detected. But it tells you how big a detector you need. For so you see here the CMB. There actually is a diffuse background of radio waves in the universe. You see that there. Notice this plot is very old. This is visible light. This is what you catch with your eyes. And notice these are GV gamma rays. And this is the region around TV. There is nothing. These are upper limits. It's actually very, you know, if you... Why are there no 1,000 TeV photons? It's very easy. You can detect 1,000 TeV photons with an air shower array, which is, by today's standards, a very cheap experiment. But there are only upper limits. And so this is the dark region I was referring to. So the idea was to do neutrino astronomy starting somewhere around, I mean, today we catch neutrinos with ice cubes starting at 10 GeV and up.
I'm sorry, what's the primary source of the radio background?
Radio galaxies.
Okay.
I think. I'm not an astronomer. the radio galaxies. So, about this picture. You realize how many orders of magnitude this is? It's amazing, actually. And in fact, here is the particle I was talking about, 10 to the 8 TeV. So in fact, the sky at these energies is dominated by cosmic rays themselves. So if you look, for instance, here, where you might, by the way, why does the sky basically stop at GV gamma rays in this picture? Notice it's old. I will tell you about the progress made. Not only do we try to do neutrino astronomy, the gamma ray experiments have pushing this to the right. But notice here, at this place, the number of cosmic rays compared to the number of gamma rays, that's 2-3 orders of magnitude. So if you look up at the sky, you better can tell a proton from a gamma ray, or you're just overwhelmed by a background. You're not doing astronomy, you're doing cosmic ray physics. And so that's the other challenge. But here are these particles I talked about that, you know, an LHC of order, the orbit of Mercury. Well, that's tomorrow. So, that's the final idea. So above GV energy or so, we're going to try to do neutrino astronomy. So this I'm going to skip. It's all in these notes. And I'm going to just tell you the essence of what's on those slides on the blackboard. When we're going to talk a lot about cosmic ray accelerators. These accelerators don't put out a monochromatic beam like the CERN accelerator. They put out some spectrum of particles. And so the critical quantity is the NDE, which tells you this is the number of particles emitted by the accelerator as a function of their energy. So the actual number is a quantity E dNdE. That's the number of particles. The NDE itself is called the flux, and the flux is sometimes referred to, astronomers like to use the letter phi. So a neutrino flux is phi nu, and so phi gamma. When you see this phi, it's the number of, it's this function. What an experiment measures, this is very important, is E dNdE. That's the number. What you actually mostly see plotted is E squared dNdE. And that's interesting because that's an energy. So that's the power the accelerator puts out. So you put, so the flux, the number of particles, the power. And especially this is interesting because theorists, although we are not sure, think that the NDE actually goes like 1 over the energy square. So when you plot E squared dNdE, which of course not what is measured, it's just a straight line as a function of E. So a cosmic accelerator, according, this goes on the name of shock acceleration, magnetic reconnection. I'll tell you a little bit about shock acceleration this afternoon. So these theoretical mechanisms to accelerate particles basically put equal energy in every wavelength of light. So if you go to 10 times higher energy, you lose a factor of 100 in particles, but the energy remains constant. That is because for 1 over E square, the number of particles go down by 100, but the energy goes up by 100 of each particle. So you just keep the energy. Of course, this file, so there is, of course, a beginning and an end to this. The accelerator turns on at some point. It can be 1 over E squared for a while, and then it cuts off because it runs out of magnetic field. I'll come, you will realize later. But so these are not monochromatic beams we're talking about.
So now that you've actually seen them, is that what the experimentally you see? Or is it
we actually, if you cannot wait until tomorrow, we discover cosmic neutrinos in 2013, and on Thursday, we're going to announce that we found cosmic accelerator. In a very interesting way, actually. It wasn't Ice Cube alone. In fact, it's one of these first, it's the first, actually, multi-messenger event in astronomy, in the sense that it could not have done by, not any single one of the telescopes would have discovered this accelerator. It's only the combination that could do it. You will see it tomorrow. But, you know, the reason this field had breakthrough is just, this is experimental science, as I have already referred to. In fact, it's beyond experimental science. Most of these things we build are a shot in the dark. Of course, you can never admit that because you get no money. But that's what it really is. And in the great tradition of building these instruments that always see much more interesting things than they predict. So in the last decades or so, We have built air shower arrays that are 100 kilometers square in size, 1,000 kilometers square in size. In fact, the Auger array in Argentina is 6,000 kilometers square. We have built large ground-based gamma ray telescopes in order to push this limit now beyond the 100 TeV region. By the way, in my old plot, the gamma ray sky already stopped at 100 GeV. That is because the telescopes we had to do gamma ray astronomy were put on satellites to get above the atmosphere. And they're about that big. And you just run out of flux of particles. They're too small to beat the 1 over E square. But people invented building detectors from the ground, and then you can build them bigger. And this worked beautifully. So, and then of course we build a fully efficient kilometer cube neutrino detector. And so that's, I'm going to tell you the rest of today. I have no idea on time in these lectures. So, but if I go too fast, it becomes messy. So I'm going to go through these three ideas. And that was the birth of particle astrophysics. I must say, of course, a lot of other interesting things happen on the way, like by building larger and larger neutrino detectors, we built Super K and, you know, found neutrino mass. So reminding us that these experiments do other things than particle physics. And if I go fast enough, I'll end tomorrow by talking about the particle physics that these experiments do. I already told you this. Victor Hess in 1912 discovered radiation from space. You actually should try to read the paper. This was a beautiful experiment. What he did was going up. He went in a balloon to 17,000 feet without oxygen in his Sunday suit. And I have a picture maybe tomorrow of him in his balloon. And he carried one of these things that you've seen in elementary lab, that when there is, you have a metal plate that detects charge, and then there are two blades that go like this. And that's all he had. But he had two of them so that he could balance the systematic errors. And he saw the charge increase. So whereas every common sense person would have thought that there is radioactivity from the Earth, there is. And so that charge would go down, he actually saw it go up. And so that was the beginning. And so I think I've said most of this by now. We have, you know, as particle physicists, this is a slide that kind of, you know, that the motivation. You know, these particles we will never get from an accelerator. So this is the only way to do this science is to just look at the sky and hope for the best. Of course, you only get this way what nature gives you. On the other one, and the beam doesn't cost anything. Nobody can turn it off. So this is, you know, the flux. And so this line here now is already pushed to 100 TeV or so. And so let me just point out this spectrum. You have seen this slide, and you've probably heard talks like mine before. And they're pointing out how from over this many orders of magnitude, the cosmic ray flux is a beautiful power. In fact, it isn't. It's on this plot. And whenever you build an experiment that looks at any part of this spectrum in detail, you actually found it full of structure. This thing is infinitely complicated because you are not only looking at the contribution of many, many sources of cosmic rays, you are looking at an instant in time. These accelerators actually turn on and off. And so, for instance, when you look at the spectrum of the cosmic rays coming from the galaxy, it's very difficult to understand. So don't think that there is some deep idea that can one power law that explains all of cosmic ray physics. The thing I want to point out here is that the highest energy cosmic rays are extragalactic. We know that since last year. You've probably been told this in every talk you heard on cosmic rays. We only know this to 5 sigma since last year. But the reason people believe that is the following. Where did I put the eraser? So, this is the galaxy. So the galaxy, I told you the magnetic field in the galaxy is a few microgauss. The best number now is 5 microgauss on average. And so if you have a cosmic ray of 10 to the 20th electron volt, what's the gyro radius? The gyro radius is bent by this magnetic field. So the gyro radius is proportional to 1 over... is... no. How am I going to... let me just draw a picture instead of doing the calculation. 10 to the 20th cosmic ray, I'll do the calculation later, would look something like this. In other words, even to a faraway source, it would point into 1 or 2 degrees. We don't know exactly. If you reduce the energy, the gyro radius becomes smaller. So a cosmic ray of 100 times smaller energy will kind of look like this. And then by the time you come to, say, 100 TeV, the gyro radius looks like this. And so you have to think of our galaxy as some kind of a magnetic bottle. And the particle has an energy where the gyro radius looks like this. Then it's trapped. And it's presumably produced in our galaxy and has stayed there for a long time. In fact, most of the cosmic rays have gyro radii like this. But if you come to 10 to the 20th, it's definitely much larger. So the idea is that sometime around 10 to the 18 electron volts, so 100 times smaller than the highest energy cosmic rays, the largest two orders of magnitude, the gyro radius is too large compared to the dimension of the galaxy. And so they must be extragalactic. They cannot be contained. But last year, the Auger experiment actually did a measurement and saw an enhancement of cosmic rays coming into the direction of where most of the sources are in the universe. So they correlated to, you know, if you're familiar with cosmology, people are now making these mass distributions of galaxies in the universe, right? And so the cosmic rays actually point towards where most of the galaxies are, which in some sense must be responsible for the acceleration somehow. It doesn't point at the center of our own galaxy. So this is a five sigma effect now. So although we knew this before, now we've measured it. Yes?
I think I missed the meaning of the lines. What is
the gyro rate. This is the part of the... This is a cosmic ray coming in from far away, billions of light years. It reaches our galaxy in a microgauss field. That's how much it's bent.
Okay, so it's the trajectory.
Yeah, it's the trajectory I'm drawing. Whereas a 100 TeV particle, maybe the gyro radius looks like that, unless the gyro radius looks like that. So particles like this can be produced in our galaxy and trapped. Particles like this cannot be produced in our galaxy. They're part of a larger population.
The correlation they found was between where generic galaxies are or where active galaxies are, the ones that we're producing?
No, just galaxies. You use one of these deep mappings, and it points at the direction of where most of the, yeah. Yes?
So, maybe one other question, but would a B field on the galaxy be in any random direction, or is it like axial? So would the actual circles be in the plane of the galaxy, of the trapped particles?
The particles that are trapped are moving mostly in the plane of the galaxy. We actually don't know how big the galaxy is in cosmic rays. I don't think that's a number I could quote for you. That tells you how little we know, actually. I mean, it's amazing, after more than a century, how little we know about this problem. That's hopefully going to change. I saw many more hands. You had a question? Yeah.
I was just curious if it was possible for extragalactic cosmic rays to become trapped in the outer tail.
No, with this gyro radius, it's very unlikely. They pass through.
That's mainly due to the fact that the extragalactic cosmic rays that do travel to our galaxies are too high of an energy.
Yeah, yeah. The energy is the key. Okay. Right? The gyro radius is one over the energy. Any other? Yes, please.
So I didn't get, is there a special thing about the galaxies that are producing the...
We don't know where they come from.
No, you said about the Auger paper, you said...
No, they make a map of the cosmic rays, their arrival directions, and there is actually a maximum in the direction of where most of the galaxies are. There's something called the supergalactic plane, which is a higher density of galaxies close to us. But if they were galactic, they would have pointed at the galactic center. They would have pointed here, right? Okay. So this is the belief. The belief is that... The cosmic, so you see here, there's no end to the imagination, e to the 2.7 times the flux. This is done in order to flatten out the picture. And so you see here, we know that these cosmic rays are galactic. We know that these cosmic rays are extragalactic. The belief, where the transition is not clear. The conventional idea is that's somewhere here around 10 to the 18, but that's now being questioned. In fact, now that slowly data is coming in on this, everything is questioned. You have to realize that, I don't know how to say this diplomatically, it's astrophysics is not, you interpret pictures you get from the sky, and doing theory is very difficult. And you know, whenever you see something, I mean, think of the discovery of gravitational waves. You know, we all believe 30 solar mass black holes didn't exist. So typically, that's typically. you know, it's, you see something, it's totally off the wall from the perspective of theory. It's the exact opposite as the standard model, fortunately, I should say. This I already have explained to you. This is just to show you, making this picture, this is an updated version. And this is, you know, this is work of many, many telescopes. I'm not going to explain this. I have already told you what a galaxy is. If you look at this from the top, you see the spiral arms, of course. And so you see here one word about units. Units in this field are incredibly, you know, everything is done in centimeters and seconds, even though you're talking about the whole universe, and in arcs. And so I have to write it down. One TeV is 1.6 arcs. So when arcs bother you, just call it TeV. Nothing I say is to this precision. Not quite, but today at least. Then the other units that are used are kiloparsec, megaparsec, gigaparsec. And so the only thing you have to know is that, I think this is right, a parsec is 3.3 light years. And so, for instance, we live here, and so the distance to the center of our galaxy is 8 kiloparsec. And the distance to the edge of the universe is 10 billion parsec. 10 billion. Yes, 10 billion. 10 to the 28th centimeter. Yeah, this is a number everybody knows in this field. Sorry. 10 to the 28th centimeter, so you can work it backwards. Units are a mess. I think I already explained this. Yeah, there is another aspect to this, which I'm just briefly going to mention. If this is the flux, you can calculate the energy in the, that the accelerators puts out. So you just integrate this, or you integrate the flux, multiply by E and do the integral. And if you see here, to an astronomer in this business, the 410 degree photons per cubic centimeter of 2.7 Kelvin, that's 10 to the minus 12 ergs per cubic centimeter. That's the energy in the universe that contained in this photon, in these microwave photons. That's about a half an MeV per cubic centimeter. That's a useful, these are useful numbers. If I calculate the energy in cosmic rays inside our galaxy, it's actually the same number. So the cosmic rays in our galaxy, the magnetic field, the microwave background, they all have the same energy density, which kind of, I think this is probably an accident. The energy that the magnetic field and the cosmic rays have the same density, that's not an accident, because it are the cosmic rays moving around the galaxy that make the magnetic field. If I integrate the highest energy cosmic rays, it depends a little bit of where I start, I get 3 × 10⁻³ ergs per cubic centimeter. That's a small number. Remember, this is like 20 orders of magnitude. But actually, as you will slowly develop a feeling for this, this is a huge number. So not only do these accelerators produce very high energy particles, they produce them, you know, the luminosity of the accelerator is very high. So if you want to make a model of these particles, it's very challenging. You have to get to this high energy and then produce them with high luminosity to match this number. And I will give you a feeling for these numbers further on. But that's why for the acceleration of extragalactic cosmic rays, there are basically only two models. This is pathetic. After 100 years, you can only think of two things. So the luminosity is very high. And that's usually not pointed out. You know, the experimentalists always tell you you have to build a 6,000 kilometer square array, and then you see one particle per year of a million TeV. Well, the conclusion is that's their problem. This is actually a huge luminosity. And so let's talk a little bit about accelerators. This is an accelerator that we kind of understand. You see, it's even in a circle to help us. this is a solar flare. And I don't know anything about solar flares, but you see, there are particles that move close to the speed of light. If they move close to the speed of light, they make magnetic fields, so you've constructed an accelerator. And so this is a coronal ejection. And so that, of course, cannot explain the cosmic rays. But similar things like that happen in the universe. This is a star that exploded, I think, 300 years ago. I think 300 years ago. So what happens is a star runs out of nuclear fuel, collapses to a neutron star, a supernova, and one solar mass of gravitational energy pushes stuff into our galaxy, into the interstellar medium. And you see these filaments? That's basically the same as you saw in the previous picture. This is an X-ray picture. So this could be like the explosion you saw from the sun, except this is 300 years old. This expands at a third to a tenth of the speed of light. And so if I knew that distance, we could tell how old it is. There is the neutron star. You actually don't see the neutron star. You see the mess around it, which I'll come back to later. That's where we produce neutrinos. And you see another example of this here. And you see these filaments. That's where the equivalent of the solar flare, but now it's much bigger. And the magnetic fields are higher. So what happens is that you set up a shock wave. And the shock wave, what it does is it transforms 4, 5, 6% of, in this case, of the energy. Remember, energy is the problem, not just acceleration, to high energy. A fraction of the gravitational energy into the acceleration of particles. How a shockwave works, I'm going to tell you this afternoon, or try to tell you. Now, how do you get a 10 to the 8 TeV particle? That doesn't work. This is, you know, you have, when a star actually collapses to a black hole instead of to a neutron star, say like a 20 solar mass star, when it runs out of fuel, it collapses to a black hole. And then it makes something which actually is called a gamma ray burst. But it doesn't matter what a gamma ray burst is. This is classification of astronomers. It's exactly the same thing as I showed you before. In fact, I show you a picture of it, and you say, well, this picture looks different. And the only reason it looks different is because there's a black hole here and it's spinning. So there is a focus. Most of it is not beautifully spherical, like the supernova remnant in the galaxy. It has a preferred direction. the spin, the magnetic fields are wound up along the spin axis of the black hole, and it becomes asymmetric. So it's exactly the same thing. Oh, here's a movie of it. Did I show that? And so this can get you to 10 to the 8 electron volt. As I said, there are two ideas. So the tapping the gravity when stars collapse, very massive stars to get to high energy. And the other idea is to tap the gravitational energy of a supermassive black hole. So this is our galaxy. In our galaxy, there is actually here a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole. And it doesn't do anything. It does very little. You know, people occasionally discover particles or gamma rays flowing out of it and think this is a leftover of the activity of that black hole. It's dead. But there are galaxies in the universe where the black hole is still active. What does it mean the black hole is active? First of all, the ones we are interested in have typically 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 10 solar mass black holes. These are called active galaxies. And so what happens is that, what does this black hole do? It's active because it eats stars, dust, everything that's in the galaxy at a very high rate. And so it just disappears behind the horizon. But not quiet. Not everything disappears in a black hole. We don't know the details of this, but it is a fact that a black hole cannot occasionally chokes. It cannot absorb all the material anymore. So material builds up around the black hole, and then eventually it throws it out along a jet, which is particular to a spin axis. So think of a spin axis as where, so you have the particles flowing in, and then along the spin axis, the magnetic field is wound up. So when it builds up this material, it throws the material out along this spin axis, and it's actually like an accelerator beam. And in fact, if you look at pictures of this beam, you see it throw out these blobs of matter. It's not a continuous beam. So this is not just a story I'm telling you. I actually have some pictures later to show you. And I should immediately point out that this is the place, again, let me take this picture. So where, if this accelerates protons, cosmic rays, as I already told you, you know, most high energy astrophysics is done with electrons and gamma rays. And so protons were and cosmic rays were considered something exotic that the universe doesn't really care about. We have shown, as I will explain to you tomorrow, that's not true. If protons are accelerated along these jets, they will interact with all the light that's surrounding this detector, this black hole. And so by p-gamma interactions, you will produce pions that decay in neutrinos. So whereas the protons are ejected but forget the direction they come from, the neutrinos do not. And so that was the concept of building a neutrino detector. So I'll talk a little bit this afternoon, but let's go a little bit to give you a feeling for how far you can get with a given accelerator picture. And so the critical thing is, if you want to accelerate a particle, the gyro radius has to be smaller than the size of your accelerator. At CERN, the gyro radius is continuously adjusted to follow the magnets. Here, let's just write that the fact that it, you know, this particle cannot be accelerated by the field in our galaxy, for instance. It just passes through. So the gyro radius is the energy over the magnetic field, and that has to be smaller than the size of your accelerator. So R is the size of your accelerator. V, everything, when you see a velocity, is the speed of light. Q is the charge, B the magnetic field. So you see, this tells you if I have a magnetic field B over a distance R, I can get to a certain energy which is given by this relation. So that's called the Hillis formula. And so you can actually plot the size versus the magnetic field. And these are the objects you may be thinking about. So what did I talk about? I talked about gamma ray bursts and active galaxies. And you see, they are kind of, if you want to get to 10 to the 8 eV, you have to be on this side of this line. Oh, sorry, on that side. If you're on this side of the light, either your accelerator isn't big enough or the magnetic field isn't strong enough. And so you see, active galaxies and gamma ray bursts barely touch this, satisfy this relation. This relation, you're a theorist, I can say this here, is dimensional analysis. So if you are on this line, like active galaxies, it means that your system has to be, every component of whatever the accelerator is, has to be fully efficient, like the CERN accelerator. And you can read supernova remnants is here, so they cannot accelerate the extragalactic cosmic rays, but they can get to a point where they explain the cosmic rays in our galaxy. In fact, I will tell you later, everybody believes they do, although there is really no reason. There is no evidence for this. I won't go through all these speculations, but you see here supernova remnants don't make it, but may explain cosmic rays inside our galaxy. And here, gamma ray bursts do make it, active galaxies barely. Gamma ray bursts were, until Ice Cube came around, the favorite theory of theoreticians in this business. You can do a simple exercise. I could assign this as a problem in units. It's so trivial. A pulsar can be an accelerator because you have a rapidly changing magnetic field. And so you just take the formula, but now V is the spin velocity, is 2 pi r divided by the period of the pulsar. So you put that in my previous calculation. And so the size of a pulsar is about 10 kilometers. The fields are 10 to the 8 Tesla. And a millisecond pulsar has a period of 1/1000 of a second. You put that in the Hillis formula, where I have replaced V by 2 pi r over t. You get 10 to the 70 V. So with this incredible system, you cannot get to the highest energy particles. And in fact, the pulsar is, if you begin to look in the details, it doesn't make much sense. But if I apply this to Fermilab, sorry, this light is old enough that there was no LHC. Tesla magnets, 4 kilometer ring, 10 to the 5 revolutions per second, you get 1 TeV. So that means when you invoke this Hillis formula, you know, it's dimensional analysis. You have to have a fully efficient system. There is something that helps. And I will quickly go through it. I won't do the details. That is that The idea is the following. An accelerator in the universe, being it some active galaxy, for instance, take an active galaxy, that's an accelerator. It may be moving at us. You know, the things move in the universe, they're not sitting there. If it moves at us, we are going to see boosted energies and contracted times. So that helps. And these boost factors may be, like in gamma ray bursts, are of the order of 1,000. And the energy is actually boosted as the end. I mean, no, I'll do that later. So it's basically a geometric effect, although it's of course also related to the change of frame. And I have a slide, and it's explained in these notes, and I, you know, will not go to the derivation, but just point out, you know, suppose, is there a pointer here? I cannot, oh yeah, of course. I remember. I've been here before one. So if this is the active galaxy, and you know, you shouldn't think of the beam of the active galaxy as an accelerator beam. It's actually a beam of accelerators you produce one after another, shock waves. It's mind-boggling, actually. Of course, you will hear tomorrow, it's the right answer. So suppose you look at a galaxy and a photon comes to us from the galaxy. And here is the jet, we are looking at it sideways. And the jet moves at 5/6 of the speed of light. So it means while after, so while this photon moves 4 times c, this will move to here, and the distance between this and here is 3 light years. So this is Pythagoras, right? 4, 3, and 5. That means if you look, here is my telescope, and I look at this photon and time the galaxy versus the accelerator I'm looking at, it will have traveled 3 light years. That's what I conclude because I see the projection on the sky. It will have, so, it moves faster than the speed of light. I don't know if this was very clear. Let me try this picture. No, that's less clear. No, I had 3 pictures for this. I think this is still the best one. So you see, you will confuse this 3 light years for and associated with the time difference of this photon and this photon arrives. So let me just read it in case you didn't get it. So this pulse arrives at Earth in 2000, and this pulse arrives 2 seconds later. So while the blob travels from here to here, the light has traveled 5 years. So when you compare, so the light from here is two light years behind on the light from there. And in these 2 light years, you measure that the blob has moved 3 light years. So it goes faster than the speed of light. But of course, there's no violation of Lorentz invariance. It's a geometric effect. And my next slide, I won't go through it, explained how it's related actually to the Lorentz boost factor. Okay, so a few nice pictures. Here you see one of the close active galaxies, M87, and you see the beam here, and you see these blobs. And these blobs are the accelerators, as I will mention later. You can actually see on the other side, you can see the second jet. Here is another M87 again. So you see, you can see the jet in the other direction. It's another picture. Okay, we've learned that. We skip this. Okay. For the rest of the talk and for tomorrow, one of the things you have to remember is, and this is the right explanation for this audience, I've been talking about accelerators. Neutrinos are not produced by accelerators. They are produced by what we call beam dumps. You go to Fermilab. What they do is they have an accelerator. They shoot it in some massive target. And then you produce all kinds of particles, including pions, and the pions decay. And everything is boosted, of course, in the direction of the beam. And so you get a neutrino beam coming out. In the universe, this is inevitably the same. Every accelerator in the universe is a neutrino beam dump, because the accelerator is a black hole or a neutron star. And they are surrounded by radiation fields. They are surrounded by dust. In our galaxy, when a cosmic ray, even a cosmic ray that's far from its accelerator, when it travels through our galaxy, it makes neutrinos. One thing about this galaxy is that the amount of hydrogen through this galaxy is 1 per cubic centimeter. So the galaxy is certainly not empty. So every cubic centimeter, there is a hydrogen on average. And some of this in molecular clouds, which provide enormous target opportunity for the cosmic rays moving around. So we always expected, actually, to see galactic sources first. Just by geometry, you have to see galactic sources first. I think we will see them, but it's actually a mystery why we didn't see galactic sources first. So let me take the case that the target is radiation. Then your accelerated proton interact with a gamma ray, produce a pi plus. Pi plus decays into a neutrino, but it also produces a proton and a pi zero. And this pi zero decays into gamma rays. And if you work through this, depending on whether it's interacting in dust or gamma rays, up to a factor of 2, you actually have to see a PV gamma ray. A PV is 1,000 TeV. I'm just taking an example. So for every 1,000 TeV neutrino you possibly see, you have to see 1,000 TeV gamma ray. I showed you a distribution, the content of the universe. There are no 1,000 TeV gamma rays. So why did this discourage us? That I will tell you about tomorrow. But so here is the same. This is a cosmic beam dump, right? You have an accelerator, you go down the jet, and here, this is baited. In fact, some gamma rays, some galaxies look blue, and that is because they have a large amount of 10 electron volt photons. And so your protons move through these 10 electron volt photons in the galaxy, and you can produce neutrinos. We worked through these examples and realized if you build a kilometer cube detector and your calculation was right, for which I wouldn't have given 5 cents, then you would see active galaxies. So, as I said, astronomers don't subscribe to this. In fact, high-energy astrophysics, if you're an astronomer, is very simple. You know, you look at textbooks. They are and very reasonable. And so this beam will accelerate electrons, and the electrons will radiate. And that's the light you see. And if you see high energy photons, it can probably not come from this. But they use the photons we are talking about and then upscatter them by inverse Compton scattering, so which should be shown. It's actually not shown on this plot. But you typically get two populations. You get electrons, so they accelerate electrons, they emit gamma rays, and then these gamma rays can meet the electrons again. And in Compton scattering, electron can give all its energy to gamma rays. It's called inverse Compton scattering. Again, this is particle data book. I'm not going to compute a cross-section. But then you get a second population. And that's how you have enough parameters to explain everything. Of course, this is what happens when you accelerate protons. You can, for instance, interact with this synchrotron, or you can interact with this blue light that I was talking about. And in fact, you can do simple calculations just using the delta resonance approximation. Who knows what a delta resonance is in this audience? Doesn't matter. It's P gamma scattering, and you look in the particle data book. And so you produce a pion. The pion decay into a muon and a neutrino, and the muon decays further. So you actually get multiple neutrinos. Okay, so this is propaganda. Okay, so now I'm going, I have 5 minutes left. I'm actually going to stop. Next, I'm going to tell you about these big experimental efforts and how they are done. And then tomorrow you will hear about neutrinos again. In fact, I'll try to introduce neutrinos already this afternoon. So I have a few minutes left. Any questions, complaints?
Can you be posting these slides on the website?
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yes, I will post the slide and I will post this opus. By the way, this opus is under construction. I don't think it has mistakes in it, but the prose is not up to the usual standards. Yes?
The email, let me upload it on the website.
So hope there are enormous files, actually, but we'll email, yeah.
The question was, when you talked about the synchrotron thing,
I'm sorry, this was probably not very clear, but...
Was that meant to be an alternative explanation of where these things come from, different from...
Yes, exactly. So let me make a second attempt at this explanation. This is extremely simple. And you know, the problem is, this is a problem, the difference between experiment and observation. So you have a beam of electrons, and they radiate photons. And so these photons are called synchrotron photons for obvious reasons. They are produced in the magnetic field of the jet. And then the electrons can meet a photon and give its energy to the photon and just they can exchange energy. This is called inverse Compton scattering. And in fact, the simplest picture is where this electron actually grabs this photon and then boosts it. So first you get, this photon can be the same photon as this one. So in other words, when you plot E squared the NDE of the accelerator, and so this is an accelerator that has only electrons. I'll show you some data this afternoon when I talk about the experiments. You will have a first population, typically in the X-ray region. And these are gamma. This is the energy. So this is the population of synchrotron photons of these. And then the electron beam can grab these photons and scatter them to direct higher energy. So you get another bump. So this is synchrotron radiation. This is the inverse quantum. And in fact, accelerators look like this. And this is the problem with observations, right? You're never sure whether this is how it actually is, or whether you just had enough parameters. Like, we don't know what a B field is, which is a parameter which is critical to give you how many synchrotron photons you have.
But there's no neutrinos here, so the handle on...
So this is the classic picture of the radiation you see from active galaxies. So if I take the M87 jet data, it looks like that, and I can explain them without any protons. So the standard picture in astronomy was that cosmic rays are some exotic phenomena that people like I worry about. But all of astronomy proceeds by accelerating electrons and radiating photons or producing them by synchrotron radiation.
But if I wanted to distinguish this kind of picture from the other one...
I'll come to that.
I would look for neutrinos.
If there is a... Actually, it always puzzled me. If you extract high-energy particles out of a black hole, how can you extract electrons to high energy and not protons?
Yeah.
Because clearly the electrons have more synchrotron radiation than protons and lose their energy faster. The answer to that is that it's the charge that matters. But then still, protons and electrons have the same charge. So, you know, this is one of these situations where you have enough parameters. There were certain observations that were hard to understand. And there were a few oddball theorists, which included me, who would argue that you needed protons to explain the features of the data. But this was never convincing. So it's tough. It's not like ATLAS and CMS. You do this field by just looking what nature gives you. And that's all the information you're going to get. Now, as I will tell you tomorrow, that's enough. So this is a bit, and it's enough after you built good enough experiments. And that's what I'm, so this afternoon will be experiments, but by a theorist. So it will not be painful. In fact, if it were painful, I wouldn't know about it. Okay. Thank you.